After this third argument, we get a fourth argument, and that begins at the bottom of 94, top of 95. Callicles says something rather scathingly after Eurystheus hears his third argument. At the very first line of 95, he says to Socrates, "As if you thought that I or any other human being did not consider some pleasures better and others worse." Now, he thinks that, he's introduced a refinement that's going to save his account, but actually this completely destroys his hedonism. If one can recognize that some pleasures are better than other pleasures, doesn't that mean that there's got to be some other standard of what's better or worse besides the pleasurable? If there are good pleasures and bad pleasures, then pleasure can't be the good. Conversely, if there are good pains and bad pains, then pain can't be the bad. So what poor Callicles has just done here is he's just given up the whole argument. And Socrates quickly draws that conclusion out of him. But you see the basic point. If there is a distinction between good and bad pleasures, then pleasure can't be the same as the good, because there are bad pleasures. If there's a distinction between good and bad pains, then pain can't be the bad, because there are good pains, too. And this means that we have a complete surrender to the claim that pleasure is not the same as the good, pain is not the same as the bad. And what we need to do is we need to appeal to some other standard of the good and the bad in order to determine which pleasures are bad for us and which pains are good for us. Now, on page 96, below the center where it says 500C, he begins to draw the implications of this out. Once we recognize that there are some pleasures that are bad and some pains that are good, then we have to start asking ourselves, well, how do we determine which pleasures are bad and good and which pains are bad and good? What is the standard of goodness is really what he's pursuing. One line below 500C, he has a fairly strong claim here. And again, this dialogue is filled with strong claims. At the end of the section we're looking at today, they're extraordinarily strong knowledge claims. He says, "For you see that our speeches are about this. And what would a human being who had even a little intelligence be more serious about than this? That is, in what way one must live." There's nothing more serious than that question. How does a human being live? "Whether the life to which you urge me on, doing these things of a man, speaking among the people, and practicing rhetoric and acting in politics in this way in which you now act in politics, or this life in philosophy, and in what respect it can be that this life differs from that one. Perhaps then it is best, as I attempted a while back, to distinguish, and having distinguished and agreed with each other, if these lives are indeed two and distinct, to examine in what way they differ from each other, and which of them one ought to live." So, this is the most important issue. What is the best life for a human being? Nothing is more important than this. And this, again, speaks to the centrality of the moral question for Platonic philosophy. This is at the core of Socrates' knowledge. Now, the way it's set up here is the choice of two kinds of lives. The public life, the life of going out there and trying to become famous and powerful through selling yourself. Right? And the life of philosophy, which is a life of spent away from the spotlight, a private life, where one's primary concern is not fame and fortune, but being good. Another way of putting it is this. In the public life, one pursues happiness through fame and fortune. In the private life, one pursues happiness through philosophy. And in a sense, you can put it this way. The philosopher is most concerned with assuring worthiness of being happy. And no one is worthy of being happy if they're a bad person, right? When you see a scoundrel who's prospering and seems to be quite happy, that's not something that anyone enjoys. It's repulsive. There's nothing more repulsive than a scoundrel who gets away with it and seems to be happy. And the most important thing, as far as philosophy is concerned, is to assure one's worthiness of being happy. Whether or not one actually ends up being happy in the worldly sense is another matter. But that can't be controlled anyway, really, by human beings. I mean, fortune, luck, play such an enormous role in disposing happiness or unhappiness in the worldly sense, that really what we need to do is we need to invest our energies in pursuing happiness in the way that we can most control. And what we can most control is ourselves, our characters. We can't control external events to the same extent. And so there's a broader choice you could formulate here. Do you pursue happiness in the realm of expediency, right? Do you pursue happiness by going out and trying to master fate, master the circumstances of your life? Or do you pursue happiness through trying to take care of the things that you really can control? And ultimately, that's going to be your own soul. Now, a person who cares for their own soul might not end up being happy in the worldly sense. They might not have a lot of things. But at the same time, they can be quite consoled in the fact that they're worthy of happiness in a worldly sense. But there's a deeper sense of happiness that Socrates wants to argue is achieved, because happiness for him is ultimately going to be the health of the soul, the most worthwhile happiness. Okay? Whereas, you know, happiness in the sense of having nice things and so forth, none of that's intrinsically good. But what's intrinsically and unconditionally good is wisdom, and wisdom is the health of the soul. And all of these things are laid out very nicely in this section. And what Socrates does is he draws Callicles to the conclusion here. And what I'd like to focus on is starting on page 101. Let's just go through the last few pages of the section for today, because it's all laid out here, and it's really very eloquent. And it's as good a sort of treatise summary of Platonic moral philosophy as anything you'll find. So, the first thing that we need to look at is at the bottom of 100, actually. About eight lines from the bottom of the main text. Socrates raises the question, "Well then, won't the good man who speaks with a view to the best say what he says not at random, but looking off towards something? Just as all the other craftsmen look toward their work, when each chooses and applies what he applies, not at random, but in order that he can get this thing he is working on to have a certain form." Right? Doesn't a person who's a good man, and he's specifically talking here in a way about the statesman, but not just the statesman that's conventionally understood, the true statesman, which is going to be the philosopher, ultimately. He's saying, look, the practitioner of the true political art, he says, is the philosopher, even though they don't go into politics, ultimately. The true art of politics is soulcraft, right? True statecraft is soulcraft, and that's what true philosophy is about. The person who is concerned with soulcraft, won't they look to something as a model in the same way that the other craftsmen look to a model when they create things? And what is that model that they look to? Well, it's going to be the proper order of the soul. Okay, so he goes on. For example, if you wish to look at painters, house builders, shipwrights, and all other craftsmen, whomever of them you wish, see how each man puts down each thing that he puts down into a certain arrangement, and furthermore, compels one thing to fit and harmonize with another. So there's pattern, arrangement, harmony, fit, okay? Until he has composed the whole and has arranged an ordered thing. The language of harmony, composition, order is all there. It's a very musical sort of language, too. And indeed, the other craftsmen and those concerned with the body, of whom we were just now speaking, trainers and doctors, they order the body, I suppose, and arrange it together. Do we agree that this is so or not? Let this be so. Then a house that happened to have arrangement and order would be useful, and one lacking arrangement would be degenerate. I say so. The same for a ship, the same for the body, he says. And what about the soul? Will it be useful when it happens to have lack of arrangement or arrangement in a certain order? From what preceded, it is necessary to agree on this too, namely that the soul has to have an order to it, if it's a good soul. You probably need health and strength. I do. Okay, Socrates says, what then is the name of that which in the body comes into being from arrangement and order? And the answer is health and strength. Well then, what about what the soul? What comes into being from the arrangement and ordering of the soul? And Socrates' answer is virtue. But what is virtue? Well, the virtues are just, if you will, moral wisdom. The various faces of moral wisdom. He ultimately argues for the unity of all the virtues, and at the core of it is practical or moral wisdom. And so, a little further down, he says, for in my opinion, the body's arrangements have the name the healthy, from which health comes into being in it, and the rest of the body's virtue. Are these things not so? They are. The soul's arrangement and orderings, on the other hand, have in my opinion the name the lawful and law, whence they become both lawful and orderly. And these things are justice and moderation. These are two of the virtues. The Greeks had four cardinal virtues: justice, courage, moderation, and wisdom. And then he goes on, that rhetor then, the artful and good one, and here is the possibility of good rhetoric. Okay. Rhetoric isn't all bad. It's a techne, and it could be used badly, but intrinsically it's not bad or good. And it can be used well. And true good rhetoric is this. That rhetor, the artful and good one, will look toward these things, namely the soul, when it applies to souls, when it applies to souls, both the speeches that he speaks and all actions. We look to the virtues when we speak and act towards others. And when he gives something as a gift, he will give it. And when he takes something away, he will take it away, always directing his mind toward how he may get justice to come into being in the citizen souls and injustice to be removed. Moderation to arise within and intemperance to be removed. The rest of virtue to arise within and badness to depart. That's true politics. And that is, of course, carried out by rhetoric, too, just like bad politics is. It's all persuasion. And Socrates, a little below 505a on page 102, says, I do not think it profits a human being to live with a degenerate condition of body, for in this way he must necessarily live degenerately, too. If your body is degenerate, then you'll live in a degenerate way, and that's not good. So the same thing with the soul, right? If you have a base soul, a disorderly soul, an intemperate, cowardly, foolish, unjust soul, then you can't allow this person to have the normal pleasures of life. Why? Because they misuse them. If you have a well-ordered soul, then you can take on all the things in the world and put them to proper use. Right? Things are no good to you unless you have the wisdom to use them well. I mean, it's the point we saw in the Euthydemus, right? You'd be better off poor than rich if you're too foolish to spend your money well. So the point comes out here again. At the bottom of 103, just below, between 505 and 506, Socrates makes another sort of strong knowledge claim. He says, I at any rate think that we must be lovers of victory in regard to knowing what is the true and what is falsehood, as regards the things we are talking about. For it is a common good for all that it become manifest. Okay, truth and falsehood. And what are we talking about? We're talking about the good life and the bad life. You know, there's nothing more important than winning when it comes to the question of the truly good and the truly bad ways of living. This is a very strong claim. He goes on, I shall therefore go through in speech how it seems to me to be. And if I seem to any one of you to agree with myself on things that are not, you must take me up on it and refute. For I, at any rate, do not say what I say with knowledge, but I am seeking in common with you, so that if one who disputes me is manifestly saying something, I shall be the first to grant it. Now, here he's making a slightly different, sort of a non-knowledge claim, right? He's saying, I don't know these things. But what in effect he's doing is he's saying, look, I'm not an authority here. Right? You have to be critical about this. And to, and be active in trying to refute me if I say things that don't seem to make sense to you. So there's a knowledge claim and a knowledge denial right there, which is kind of interesting. At the top of 104, Gorgias comes in, and what's happening now is that, that Callicles wants to quit the conversation because he knows he's losing. And, you know, the question is, earlier on in the Gorgias conversation, Gorgias, are you one of these men who loves to win, or are you one of these people who wants to get to the truth? Because sometimes getting to the truth requires that you lose an argument. And Gorgias pipes up at this point, and it's very clear that Gorgias is the kind of guy who's not a lover of victory more than a lover of truth. So this is a good characteristic of Gorgias that comes out. And he says, look, you know, Callicles, finish the argument. And Callicles won't finish it, or at least he won't for now. And so Socrates is forced to just sort of sum up. Callicles says, speak, good man, and finish it yourself. He's not going to help anymore. This is about two-fifths of the way down in 104. And then there's this marvelous summary, and let's just go through this and look at it, because it really is very fine. Okay. But listen to me take up the argument from the beginning. Are the pleasant and the good the same thing? No, not the same, as Callicles and I agree. Must the pleasant be done for the sake of the good, or the good for the sake of the pleasant? Well, the good is more important, right? So you do pleasant things for the sake of the good. And is the pleasant this thing through which we are pleased when it comes to be present? And is the good that through which we are good when it is present? Certainly. But surely we are good, both we and other things that are good, when some virtue comes to be present. Isn't virtue the thing that makes us good, he's saying. It seems necessary to me, Callicles. Now then, the virtue of each thing, of implement, body, soul too, and every living being does not come to be present in the finest manner simply at random, but by arrangement, correctness, and art, which has been assigned to each of them. Are these things so? I say yes. He's sort of giving Callicles' responses to, because Callicles won't. Okay. Then, is the virtue of each thing something that has been arranged and ordered by arrangement? I should say so. Is it therefore a certain order arising in each thing's own order that makes each of the beings good? It seems so to me, at least. Then is a soul too that has its own order better than a disordered one, necessarily. The orderly soul is a better soul than a disorderly one. And surely the one that has order is orderly? Seems to follow. Yeah. How do you become orderly? Well, you get some order, okay? very necessary. Okay, he goes on. How would it not be? Exactly. And the orderly one is moderate, moderation, one of the cardinal virtues. Very necessarily, the moderate soul is therefore good. I don't have any other things to say against these, Callicles, my friend, but if you do so, teach us. Or if you do, teach us. So he's refuted Callicles finally, because Callicles was saying moderation is for suckers. Socrates is saying moderation is what makes the soul good. Moderation is that by which we discipline our potentially infinite and chaotic churning desires and create an orderly soul. And an orderly soul is a good soul, whereas a disorderly soul is a bad soul. So the moderation that he recommends is a necessary condition for the health of the soul. Ruling oneself is necessary for the health of the soul. And since the health of the soul would seem to be a very important requirement for a person in political power, it's really a necessary condition for a ruler to rule himself before he's qualified to rule others. You don't want a person in a position of power who can't control themselves, whose soul is base, chaotic, wretched. Because they're precisely supposed to be a source of order and a repository of wisdom. And how can a person be a source of order and a repository of wisdom if their soul is racked by folly and intemperance and chaos? And I think this is profoundly true. And again, the core for Plato is always character. That's the most important thing about us. The most important judgment you can pass on yourself or another is a judgment about the worth of one's character. So he goes on, and he does the opposite now, right? Because let's talk of 105. I say then that if the moderate soul is good, the one that suffers the opposite to the moderate is bad, and this would be the foolish and intemperate soul, certainly. And surely the moderate man would do fitting things concerning both gods and human beings, for he who does unfitting things would not show moderation. These things are necessarily so. And surely he who does fitting things concerning human beings would do just things, and concerning gods, pious things. And he who does just and pious things must, of necessity, be just and pious. These things are so. And indeed, of necessity, courageous as well, for it is not the part of a moderate man either to pursue or flee things that are not fitting, but to flee and pursue what he ought, affairs, human beings, pleasures, and pains, and to abide and be steadfast wherever he ought. So it is very necessary, Callicles, that the moderate man, as we have described him, since he is just, courageous, and pious, must be the completely good man, and the good man must do what he does well and nobly, and the man who does well must be blessed and happy, while the base man who does badly must be wretched. And this would be the one in an opposite condition to the moderate man, the intemperate man, whom you were praising. Poor Callicles, he's been soundly whipped at this point. This is why he doesn't want to participate in the argument. And then Socrates goes on, I therefore lay down these things in this way, and I assert that they are true. It's a very strong claim. And he goes on to criticize poor Callicles for his ignorance of math, if you will, which is an interesting thing. But before we do that, let's go to the top of page 107. Well, actually, I think we have time for this. Let's just go back to the bottom of 105. The very last two lines in 105, the wise say, Callicles, that heaven, earth, gods, and human beings are held together by community, friendship, orderliness, moderation, and justice. By the way, Heidegger is famous in his later writings for this notion called the fourfold. And it's earth and sky, gods and mortals. And I think that the fourfold in Heidegger comes out of this listing here. Okay. Heaven, earth, gods, and human beings are mortals. And as far as I know, no one's ever made that point in literature, but I think that it's what Heidegger is referring to in this passage in the Gorgias, because he's talking about the order of the cosmos, too, in some way. The wise say, Callicles, that heaven, earth, gods, and human beings are held together by a community, friendship, orderliness, moderation, and justness. And on account of these things, comrade, they call this whole a cosmos. The word order there is cosmos. Not disorder, not chaos and intemperance. You, however, seem to me not to turn your mind to these things, wise though you are about them. But it has escaped your notice that geometrical equality has great power among gods and human beings, whereas you think one must practice taking more, for you have no care of geometry. And what's being anticipated here is Aristotle's account of distributive justice, which you find in his Ethics. And there he talks about how it's appropriate that the good have more than the inferior. And Callicles agrees with that. Where Callicles would disagree is that Socrates says the good should have more than the less good, proportionate to the difference of quality between them. So if somebody is superior, it doesn't mean that they should get it all, or however much they want, but that there's a proper proportion. So say if somebody is 10 times better than somebody else, when you're distributing rewards, they should get 10 times the reward. If you give them 20 times, or if they demand 20 times, then they're out of geometric just measure, and they're intemperate and bad. And so this is going back to the earlier claim that Callicles was saying, which of course was related to his claim that we should have huge desires and big appetites and satisfy them, is that superiority does grant superior rights, but even that has to be moderated by proportionality, by justice. The superior human being does not, by virtue of their superiority, rise above concerns with proportionality and justice. So this, I think, is extremely valuable. Socrates gives the superior man his due. And he's very Greek. The Greeks believe that those who are better should get more and do better than those who are worse. Especially in politics. We want wiser men to rule. Well, we have a sort of odd system here, because we don't have any kind of proportional equality. For instance, you know, in our tax system, which is different from distributive justice. A person who earns 10 times more than me probably pays 20 times more taxes. Why? Because it's not proportional. The rates are different. On page 107, at the top of 107. Okay. So anyway, let's just wrap it up. We only got one more page. At the bottom of 106, four lines down, Socrates says, "I deny Callicles that being unjustly struck a crack on the jaw is most shameful, or having my body or my purse cut. Rather, striking and cutting me and my things unjustly is more shameful and worse." Again, it's worse to do injustice than to suffer it. "And for that matter, stealing, enslaving, housebreaking, and in short, doing any injustice whatsoever to me and my things is both worse and more shameful for him who does injustice than for me who suffers injustice. These things above there in the earlier arguments manifestly appear to us in this way that I am saying. And they are held down and bound, if it is possible to say something rather rude, with iron and adamantine arguments." This is an extremely strong knowledge claim. Look, I have proved with iron and adamantine arguments that it is better to suffer than to do injustice if forced to choose between the two. Okay, as it would seem at any rate, "and if you or someone more youthful than you do not loosen them, he who says something different from what I am now saying won't be able to say anything fine." I'm sorry, if you disagree with me, you're just wrong, he's saying. You know, that's another very strong claim. "For my speech is always the same. I do not know how these things are, but of those people I fall in with, as now, no one who says something different is able not to be ridiculous." He says, I don't know how this is the case in some way. He's saying, look, you know, there's maybe some deep level in which he finds these facts sort of baffling as to why it's so. But to deny it is to be ridiculous. There's a kind of modesty that creeps in there. "And if so, the greatest of evils is injustice, for the doer of injustice, and still greater evil than this greatest one, if that's possible, is for the doer of injustice not to pay the just penalty. What help would it be for not being able to provide himself with which a human being would be ridiculous in truth?" I mean, that's a hard sentence, but he's saying, look, the only thing worse than doing injustice is getting away with it, and not paying a just penalty. Because the just penalty, if it is a just penalty, is a curative to the sickness of injustice in one's soul. Look at the very bottom of 107. "Now, what about doing injustice," Socrates says, five lines at the bottom. "If he does not wish to do injustice, is this sufficient, if one doesn't wish to do injustice? For he will not do injustice, or against this thing, too, must one prepare a certain power and art." Well, actually, let's go up a little bit. He's saying, look, what do you need to do in order to ensure yourself against suffering injustice and against doing it? Well, there's really nothing you can do to secure yourself against suffering injustice, in a way, because fate can't be controlled, right? Other people can't be controlled. But what about doing injustice? What is the power and art that one must have in order to make oneself immune from doing injustice? Well, one has to care for the soul, right? Practice morality. And so at the very bottom, the very last line of 107, were Polis and I, in your opinion, correctly compelled in the earlier speeches to agree, or were we not, when we agreed that no one does injustice wishing to do so, but all doers of injustice do so involuntarily? So he raises that question, and that's where I want to break off. And we'll go on and finish up the dialogue next time. But that is the great question for Socrates. Do those who do injustice do so wishing to do injustice? Or do they do so involuntarily in this sense, by mistaking something for being just that's actually, in fact, unjust? That's what he means by involuntarily doing it. He doesn't mean going crazy or having a muscle spasm and hurling a rock at somebody. You know? It's not that. It's simply acting out of ignorance or error. And that's really the great question we've dealt with tonight. So anyway, let's come back next time.